Hello and welcome to the Dream Swarm podcast. This is your home for supernatural film, stories and art. I'm your host, magic realist filmmaker Andy Mark Simpson. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin.
Welcome everyone to the next episode of Dream Swarm. This episode is going to be a folk horror special. So I'm really pleased today to be joined by Darren Charles, who's part of the folk horror revival group. And he's going to be chatting to us about the genre. So welcome, Darren.
Really nice to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Would you be able to just briefly introduce yourself and what the folk horror revival group is?
So I'm Darren Charles, and I've worked alongside the group creator Andy Pechorek since we kind of brought the whole thing into being back in 2014 as a Facebook group that's kind of grown and expanded into various other things. We now have a blog. We've put out books under our own imprint of Weird Harvest Press. We organised various live events with talks and music and films. That's essentially the folk horror group and how it's come to be. It started off literally us, a handful of people, and it's now reached 23,000 members. So we must be doing something right.
It's an enormous growth in it. And we'll chat a bit later about why folk horror appeals to people so much and why there's, you know, the group's grown so well. For audiences who aren't quite sure, and I guess I'm not sure myself really, is what is folk horror? Is it possible to define folk horror?
It's not simple to define what folk horror is. It's probably exactly what most people think it is, if that makes sense. It's hard to define, but it tends to be one of those things that you kind of know. If you understand what I mean, when you do dig into it, you kind of think, that is exactly what I thought it was. Andy Pechorek, in one of his essays, wrote that it's kind of like trying to build a box the shape of mist. It's ever-changing and ever-moving. It's not this, like, simple, straightforward, there you go, that's it wrapped up in a box. When you do try to define it, I think the best place to really start with that is what we call the Adam Scoville's folk horror chain, which is a chain of four different factors that come together to kind of create what we would typically call folk horror. So the four key factors that Adam Scoville identified were landscape, isolation, skewed moral and belief systems, and a happening or a summoning. Now, the theory is that folk horror film would have at least most of those elements to it. One example would be the Wicker Man. Perfect example because it's the most famous, most renowned film. The genre. Landscape plays a crucial part in the story because, of course, you've got this fantastic little island off the coast of Scotland. You have a group of people who are part of that landscape. They're not just sort of living on that landscape. They're almost like part of the landscape, really, aren't they? The island is isolated. The people of the islanders are isolated from the rest of the mainland in more ways than one. But of course, as well, Sergeant Howie arrives on the island and he's quite isolated himself because, of course, everybody else on the island is a pagan and he's a Christian. So he's isolated in more ways than one, too. So isolation is key in The Wicker Man. The skewed moral and belief systems, of course, you've got two very different belief systems kind of butting up against each other in the film. And I think you always find it, or at least I always find that when I watch it, you never feel as though one is particularly right or wrong. Mm-hmm. There's aspects to both that are positive, there are aspects to both which are kind of negative. And I quite like that. I think that that's really important in what Robin Hardy's perhaps trying to say with the film, is because he's trying to kind of say that, well, really, whatever we believe is what we believe. Is it right or wrong? Well, you know, it's what you believe. Doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. There is no right or wrong with regards to this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think when it comes, certainly a happening or summoning is the ritual at the end of the film, which I won't mention because I would imagine most people have seen the film and know what the big epic finale is, but we'll
you never know, yeah,
just in case. So as you can see, that the Wicker Man fills all of those kind of criteria, as do many of the other films. Some may fill three of the criteria or, you know, two. They can still fit within the parameters of what we would call folk horror.
It's quite a nebulous collection of things, but Adam Scoville's tried to analyze it and break it down into certain common factors that might be found across those things that you're saying. That seems like a really good way to go about it. So you've given an example of the Wicker Man being kind of the real archetype example of folk horror. Yeah. What other examples are there that people could look to? What's kind of the history of it, or, you know, through some examples? Is it an old genre, or the modern versions of the genre as well?
The genre didn't exist as a name until fairly recently. But we can head back at least as far as Haxan, Craft of the Ages. I think that definitely fits the bill for a folk horror.
Was that a silent movie, that one?
It was, yeah. It's a silent movie, 1922, Danish filmmaker, semi-documentary, semi-made-up film about witchcraft through the ages. He used, certainly, a lot of the accounts from witchcraft trials, and he used the Malleus Maleficarum and things like that as his source material, and kind of spiced it up a little bit. But it's a fascinating piece of film. It looks amazing, even today. Some of the sequences are truly, truly astonishing. There's a sequence of a witch's Sabbath, and they all line up to kiss the devil's backside and things like that. It's fantastic imagery. And all the costumes and things are just tremendous. It's a wonderful piece of film. Thoroughly enjoyable, absolutely batshit crazy, very much in line with what we're talking about, because it analyzes what it means to be, or what it is to be a witch, what it was to be a witch, or to be accused of witchcraft in that period. So it's quite interesting. It's almost like a starting point, really. Another important point is probably the late 1950s with films like Night of the Demon. Also in the 1950s, you've got people like Nigel Neal coming through. So Nigel Neal is a TV writer, screenwriter, who wrote Quatermass stories. And he went on to write things like The Stone Tape. And there was a TV series called Beasts, which was also particularly good. And there was an episode of that in particular called The Baby, which has a very, very folk horror feel to it. As well as that, he wrote a brilliant episode of another series. You can actually get the episode. The episode is included on the Beasts DVD, and it's called Moraine. And it's a short film, and that is also very, very good. And it really kind of evokes the whole folk horror scene. His work throughout the 60s and 70s particularly was really important in setting up the parameters of what we now call folk horror. There are various other films and TV series. There was a great one-off film for TV called Robin Redbreast, which I think was in 1970 or 71. It's almost like a dry run through for The Wicker Man, because if you watch Robin Redbreast, you can just kind of say, well, yeah, that's where they got that from, for The Wicker Man. It's very, very similar. Very similar in tone and everything. So that's well worth checking out. That's out on DVD or Blu-ray from BFI. It's well worth a look.
On your Folk Horror Revival website, there's some great examples. I was like, I'm going to check out some of those. So speaking of witches, I watched The Witchfinder General yesterday, which I know is kind of mentioned as one of the prime examples of folk horror. And Blood on Satan's Claw as well, that it's often mentioned, linked with The Wicker Man. Isn't it a similar time period of when it was released?
Yeah, I think those three films, The Witchfinder General, Blood on Satan's Claw, and The Wicker Man, the three were released in a period of about 4 or 5 years between them. And they kind of form what we now call the unholy trinity of folk horror. They're kind of the three films that Mark Gatiss pushed to the fore as prime examples of the genre. So since then they've formed this unholy trinity, all quite unique and quite different to each other as well. Yeah, they all do stick largely to the folk horror chain. There's no real supernatural element to Witchfinder General. All the witches that were tried in The Witchfinder General are just, it's not real. It never was believed to be a real witch hunt. It was purely a case of, well, I don't like that person that's accused them of witchcraft. There was a lot of that sort of thing going on at the time. So the Witchfinder General stands out in that respect. The other two films have a much more, I suppose, much more of a pagan sort of heart to them. Yeah, Blood on Satan's Claw definitely has a supernatural element. The Wicker Man, you're always unsure, aren't you? You're kind of left in a position where, well, does this like save their harvest? Are their beliefs real? It's never sort of expanded upon. You don't know whether their sacrifices are worth it in the end. And even if they are, I mean, you don't know whether that would have made a difference. There may not be any supernatural element to The Wicker Man, but it's never explained either way, is it? You never get any sort of closure on that.
Yeah, you don't see what happens afterwards.
It's always open to interpretation, and I quite like that about it.
Just to rattle through a few more examples then, I watched Children of the Stones TV series, which
is
a children's TV series.
Yeah, yeah. Dark children's TV series, I would say. It used to be on ITV about tea time. You would settle down to watch that and before you had your tea, you know, when you came home from school. Just seems something so, like, so much more than that, doesn't it? It's quite a heavy series. And I actually, a few years ago, we went to Avebury where it was filmed. And I rewatched the series with my daughter, who was, I think she was about 12 at the time, 12 or 13 at the time. And we rewatched the series in the days before we went. So that was really quite interesting to just kind of go there, having just watched the series, and you just kind of relive all those moments. But yeah, it's so much darker than modern children's television, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen the Owl Service as well.
No, I've not seen that one yet.
Well, the Owl Service is kind of based on the Mabinogion, the old Welsh folklore tales. Again, it's quite dark and quite in depth for children's television. There's a lot going on, and there's a lot to kind of dig out of it. And you can't, I don't think you can really appreciate it all till you're kind of older and you watch it as a grown-up, and it's like, yeah, that's great, that's fantastic. But as a child, would I have spotted most of this? No, so much stuff in there to draw out of both series. And that's what I love about the 1970s kids TV, because it asked so much more of you. It asked so much more of children. Look into it, you know, and what more draw out of this. And it was a very literary time. So a lot of these things, particularly things like The Owl Service, which started life as one of Alan Garner's books. And as well as that, it had its roots in literature through the Mabinogion as well. It's kind of interesting that you're kind of introducing this to this very literate idea of television to a very young audience, which I think they don't do so much these days, which is really sad.
Yeah, there is an intelligence to it. Like, just think, The Children of the Stones. I watched it twice and then looked it up. Just the plot is that complicated. I'm like trying to figure it all out.
It is. And I mean, The Owl Service is even more complicated. But as an adult, you really, really do appreciate it. And I think it's something that kind of works on two levels. I mean, I introduced my children to all the weird children's TV of the 1970s and 80s. So I can kind of gauge what a modern youth audience can get from it. And my kids loved it. My kids loved The Owl Service. They loved Children of the Stones. It doesn't patronize them, and it doesn't leave them feeling as though they're being talked down to or anything. It's like, we're going to treat you how you want to be treated. We're going to ask you difficult things. We're going to explain difficult things to you, but we're going to leave a little bit for you to do as well. And I think that children like that. Children like to be challenged. And I don't think we get that enough today. I don't think children are challenged enough by our television and our films. So I'm a little bit sad about that, because I do think that period from the late 60s through to the early 80s, there was so much good television for children. So much good television, even beyond the folk horror stuff, when you get into sort of sci-fi and really, really good time for children's television.
You've given us a sense of the appeal of it to you now as an adult, but also that your kids have enjoyed the TV of the time. And you were saying just at the start, like, your folk horror revival group is 23,000 members. It seems to have almost like exploded in the last 5 years or so. So what is the appeal of folk horror? You've discussed it about in terms of how it was presented in that form in children's television, but all these films were mentioned going back to the silent movies in the 50s, and then those three Unholy Trinity of the late 60s, early 70s. But then there's like modern ones as well, like Kill List. I've seen, just watched Midsummer. So there's a few of these. So what do you think is the appeal of this genre?
It kind of always seems to rise to the fore when things aren't great. Look back at what we call the first wave, which is the late 60s, early 70s. And by no means was it just those three films we mentioned. I mean, there's a host of other great films and TV from that period. 1960s, you've got things like Mario Bava's Black Sunday, and you've got The Witches, and you've got Night of the Eagle. So there's loads of great films from that era. A lot of it was kind of a backlash to what's going on in the world at the time. So you've got Vietnam, you've kind of got the death throes of the hippie dream in the late 60s and early 70s. You've got all this kind of trouble with communes and things like the Manson family and all that sort of stuff going on. Britain at the time is incredibly depressed economically. You've got a lot of changes that have happened in that area as well, with civil rights, the rise of feminism. So there's an awful lot going on, and there's a lot of people are very angry and very upset at various things. It always seems to kind of rise to the fore. People look favorably back at these ideas of this sort of pastoral, rural past that people kind of look back on favorably. And I think looking at modern day, we're seeing a lot of this sort of rising up again in the face of things like the Trump administration in America, conservative administration in the UK at the moment, Brexit, COVID, the war in Israel, just so much negativity at the moment. And that's partly why we're seeing the rise in it again, as people kind of look for something, certainly spiritually, people are looking for something different. So it leads them into more traditional and folkloric interests. And that leads on to interest in the films and in the books and things like that. Because of course, folk horror, to term it, just think of it just as a film industry, it's beyond that, because it goes into art and literature and music and everything. I mean, it really does kind of encompass different forms of art within one. Yeah, I think it always does seem to kind of rise to the fore. As I say, just in times of unrest and craziness, yeah, as we've experienced over the last few years, where everything just seems kind of off kilter and slightly odd, it's just kind of risen to the fore again.
Yeah.
Interest in what we would now call the old ways and things like that. People have become like really fascinated by folklore and tradition. And I think it gets them away from that reality, it takes them away from the reality of, you know, governments who don't care and wars and just a general sort of depressing sort of state. Really, at the moment, isn't it? It takes people out of that and back into something that's rooted in their past and rooted in our collective past, I suppose.
Yeah, and I guess people are like getting back to nature and respecting nature, like environmental movements and that's kind of at the forefront of society now, as it was in the 60s as well, getting back to the land and respecting that. So maybe that's part of the influence of folklore, and obviously there's a rise in folk horror, but folklore as well, like it's seen a huge boost, and I know they're kind of related.
Yeah, I think it's that rise in interest in folklore that kind of leads people down the path into folk horror. You kind of get hooked on the folklore, and then you start looking around for sort of films or books that are based around that, and that's where it leads you into the folk horror sphere, I suppose.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably the same for me, because I'm not a horror film watcher compared to some people, and I really watched so few horror films, but I'm really interested in folklore, and I think that is kind of what led me on to folk horror and learn more about that. So when you hear it, or when people who aren't as into folk horror, when they hear folk horror, how similar is it to other horror genres? Is it as horrific as that? How does it kind of relate to that, do you think?
I think it's hard to say. I think, if you look at the films within the scope of folk horror, quite a few of them are perhaps not what you would term traditional horror anyway. And actually, I think sometimes it's difficult if we look at the Unholy Trinity for a start. It's questionable whether two of them are actually horror movies at all. Wicker Man is it a horror? I don't think it is. I think it's very difficult to pin it as a horror movie. It doesn't really have any horror except for the last 5 minutes. And the same can be said of Witchfinder General. I mean, it looks like a Western with all that sort of expanse of land and people riding about on horses through the countryside, and you know, it looks like a spaghetti Western in many respects.
It's probably almost plotted like a Western as well, you could imagine.
Well, it is, yeah. If I'm honest, I think he actually said at the time he made it that that was the intention.
Oh, right.
That it was a Western set in the 17th century. Tremendous. As well as that, I mean, it's based on, loosely, of course, based on true story. It's not horror story per se. It's based on things that actually happened. So it's more of a historical epic, I suppose you would say.
Yeah, I got that feel as well.
There's no supernatural aspect to it either. So I think various other films within the folk horror sphere, which are not horror movies, Requiem for a Village, definitely not a horror movie in any way, shape or form. Yet, when you watch it, it's a folk horror film. I always think, because it's called folk horror, that term, that horror kind of means you take it one way of two. Some people will take it as purely as the title suggests and think of it as a horror genre, whereas others kind of think, well, actually the term folk horror becomes a little bit of a problem because so many of the films that fit within the genre aren't actually horror. So people will say, well, that's not a horror film, but it's a folk horror. So it does get very complicated.
Yeah, and if you're looking for a horror film and you're really into other kinds of horror. You're maybe not used to the kind of slow burn of The Wicker Man, or I've just watched Midsommar, which doesn't have, it's 2.5 hours long and has 20 minutes of horror at the end. Yeah, so it's that kind of, it's more the folk is the emphasis rather than the horror as much, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've seen The Lighthouse. Is another one I've watched recently, which I absolutely loved. It's a very dark film. Incredibly dark, incredibly slow. But again, there's not too much horror involved, yet it is definitely a folk horror film. You know, it again sort of makes a mockery of that name, I suppose.
I read on your folk horror revival site, there's an essay by Andy Pacharek, which kind of introduces some of the things we've been talking about, but also has how folk horror blends into, I don't know, general weirdness and like time shift and not spacey sci-fi, but very kind of down-to-earth sci-fi and other things. And I know there's kind of a sister group that you've got with folk horror revival called Urban Weird. So could you just tell us what that's about and how that kind of links to folk horror?
I guess what a lot of people think of is folk horror tends to be rooted in a sort of rural setting. Cases in point would be, if we look at The Witch, it's set in the middle of the woods. If we look at Blood on Satan's Claw, it's set in a small rural village in England, lots of fields and lots of wooded areas. So that rural aspect is always generally prevalent within folk horror. However, what Adam Scoville fell upon when he coined the term urban weird would be that this idea of folk horror in urban areas, because of course you do get things like, you get all those stories of strange goings on in cities. You do have history beneath the soil. You know, there's certain things. I mean, in Newcastle, a city we both know, there are plague pits within, underneath the city. You know, there's an immense amount of history to kind of, if you dig beneath what's there, and you don't even need to dig. I mean, we've got the castle and all that sort of stuff. And the town moor where the witches were hanged and things like that. So there's a lot of spaces within cities which have this energy, I suppose. Urban weird comes from that, as well as things like the tales, you know, the urban tales of strange and weird things going on. Urban legends, they all tie in with that as well. That's kind of what urban weird is. So a film that would fit within urban weird would be something like The Candyman, which has folkloric aspects, but it's set in an urban environment. It has a supernatural aspect to it as well, which of course fits within the folk horror chain. There's isolation. The landscape is just replaced with a sort of urban landscape instead, and largely they are very similar. So just transplanting ideas of folk horror from rural settings to urban settings.
I mean, I can think of examples. Well, in Newcastle, we're both based in the northeast, and northeast is full of urban weirdness, I would say. It's full of history creeping through as well. On the Facebook group for Folk Horror Revival, people post examples of folk horror and things, but then there's some quite deep discussions around those as well, and they're good kind of friendly discussions. I know it's moderated and people are reasonable in have disagreements but are reasonable about it, but there's lots of discussion about the types of messaging in folk horror and what meaning people can take from certain films. So what do you think some of the messages are? What kind of comes across as like take-home messages for you?
I think quite a lot of it is trying to get under the skin a little bit of people. If we take something like The Wicker Man, for example, I always get that message from The Wicker Man is that there's no right and wrong within the sort of spiritual side of things. There are things that you applaud Sergeant Howie for. The fact he cares so much about finding Rowan Morrison, the fact that he really does believe what he believes in, which kind of works with the others as well, because obviously they believe in what they believe in as well. Ultimately, they want to have a good harvest, and that this is how they think they're going to get a good harvest. You can kind of look at both sides and go, well, I can understand how they feel. However, Howie comes across as arrogant and unpleasant at times and judgmental, and yet at the same time he's obviously caring, he's obviously officious, he obviously wants to do the right thing. And it's just, you've got two very different perspectives kind of butting up against each other. Neither one's correct, neither one's wrong, they're just different. And I think that's one of the key things we're meant to draw out of The Wicker Man, is that neither's right, neither's wrong, they're just different. Instead of fighting against difference, we just got to accept the differences and move on, rather than go to war with each other over things like that.
Yeah, I know one of the discussions was whether, is there an element of colonialism, was the word that someone used, where you've got someone from a more developed, educated society going into a less educated society and kind of treating those beliefs as inferior and wrong and uneducated. But then, I don't know, when you look at examples like the Wicker Man, it's not an uneducated society. Like, the guy's like a lord and he's been to university and everything, who's running that, and that they've chosen those beliefs not in out of ignorance but out of a belief system. Likewise, like Midsommar, which I've just watched, where, you know, they're all very intelligent, some of them are university students and they're there. So there is a debate to be had, but I think it's kind of the waters are a bit muddy. It's not like more, it's not a black and white.
I think it's that idea of they're deeply entrenched in tradition. In a lot of ways, someone who studies as a priest spends all that time at university studying theology. So they're obviously extremely well educated, but do they still believe in something that science has kind of said does not exist? If you know what I mean, it's that sort of juxtaposition between education and tradition, and people believe in their own traditions and their own beliefs, despite the fact that education will tell them actually that not real. You know, science tells us that there probably is no God. Scientists still believe in God. You know, it's something I don't think any of us will ever truly understand, or why it happens, why people think that way, whether it's to do with the way they're raised or what. Some people just kind of develop that later in life, but they believe it anyway. That's part and parcel of it all, this kind of strange idea that people who would normally say, actually, yeah, that's probably not true, that's probably not real because science dictates that this is the way things are, but actually they still believe it anyway. It's a kind of strange little position to be in.
Yeah, like it leaves it as a conundrum, really, and open-ended.
It's a conundrum. It's an interesting thing. And I think a lot of that sort of thinking goes into the folk horror cinema, certainly with respect to The Wicker Man. There's a lot of stuff, particularly in Blood on Satan's Claw, about the idea of the commune. And I know Piers Haggard was fascinated. Mary Bell, the child murderer from the Northeast, actually. He was also fascinated by Charles Manson, the Manson family. And so there's a lot of that kind of went into Blood on Satan's Claw with regards to the children all kind of forming a unit behind Angel Blake. They're almost like forming a commune of their own. Kind of came up just at the point where we were starting to see the failure of a lot of communes. So it throws it into a negative light. But that negative light's already there because a lot of the commune systems are starting to fail, and you're starting to find that a lot of these leaders were not who they were claiming to be. They were using their position to get to girls and money. And so it's quite a cynical film in that respect, I suppose. But, you know, it's what was going on at the time.
Yeah, so it reflects the time. And I guess that's part of the thing of it being quite a nebulous genre, is that it's going to move and people are going to absorb what's going on in reality, and then also want to escape that reality. And it's this kind of mix of the real and the imagined that kind of comes together in this way, which is, you know, not quite full-on horror, as you say, but it's folk horror. It joins various bits of isolation and folklore, and then there's that urban weird side of it as well.
Yeah.
From this chat, I mean, there's loads I'm going to go and watch now and explore to look further in it. I'm sure the audience will as well. So how can people follow you guys? Then what's the best way? Got the folkhorrorrevival.com is the website there.
That's the blog, yeah. We post loads of reviews and interviews and various other odds and ends up on there. Essays, and we use it as a place to educate if we can, you know, just to kind of get information out there for people to kind of make their own opinions about things. So we'll throw up interviews with various people within the scene, or we'll throw up reviews of books or films or music or anything that kind of ties in. So that's one of our main things now, is the blog. But also our Facebook group, which is just called Folk Horror Revival. And if you want to join, you just answer a few questions and one of our admins will be along shortly afterwards to admit you. And yeah, there's loads of great stuff goes on in there. We've been kind of keen to ensure that it's monitored as much as possible, just to kind of keep out some of the neo-Nazis and such like. We don't really want any of that. You know, our admins do a fantastic job trying to make it as safe a place as possible. We've had lots of really positive reports from people. Usually if one does find their way through, they don't last very long. We have had numerous attempts by sort of far right, but we usually stop them before they get in. And even if they do get in, we will, once they show their true colours, we will nip it in the bud as much as possible. You know, there's no place for that sort of thing in what we call folk horror. It's been a big problem in neo-folk for a few years now, and so we're trying to kind of ensure we keep that sort of side of things out of it as much as possible. But we get lots of really, really, really good interest and discussion, and usually, you know, as long as people are fair, honest, and respect one another's opinions, where we just kind of leave things to follow their own path, really. But we do get loads of really good stuff. You can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram. Just type Folk Horror Revival into any of those, you'll find us through that. We're hoping to get back into organizing live events and things in the coming months and years. So at the moment, fingers crossed, we're hoping to get something organized for the end of November. And with the previous events, I mean, we've done some really, really good events. Our first was a live event at British Museum. It had a bit of everything, really. We had talks, we had music, we had film. There were a number of lectures and talks. Rhys Shearsmith came along as well, and he joined our little panel at the end of the day. Obviously, Rhys is quite fascinated by the whole folk horror thing. I mean, he's in a couple of films within the parameters of folk horror, and certain aspects of his TV work fit as well. Both Inside Number 9 and
League of Gentlemen
have aspects that are folk horror. But of course, he's in Field in England and In the Earth, two Ben Wheatley films, both firmly entrenched within what we would term folk horror.
Hopefully you get back to the live events sooner rather than later then. And
yeah, but yeah, well, as I say, we've got something kind of penciled in for November of this year, and some really good stuff lined up for that.
So for everyone that can follow on folkhorrorrevival.com on the internet, and then on Twitter, it's @folk_horror, and also this Instagram as well. Really great, Darren, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dream Swarm podcast. I've been your host, Andy Mark Simpson. We hope you'll join us for the next one. Remember, you can subscribe to stay in touch with future episodes and follow us at the website www.dreamswarm.org, or follow on Twitter and Instagram @dreamswarm. And we look forward to joining you for more supernatural film stories and art. In the meantime, be creative, be curious, be kind. We'll see you soon.